Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. So you drive a Prius, and maybe you take some pride in the idea that by using less gasoline, you're helping the planet. Not so fast. Our guest today points to something called the Prius fallacy. Our car fuel efficiency has risen. Gas consumption has gone up, not down. When you think you're saving energy, you're actually ending up driving more. Put a solar panel array on your roof, he suggests, and you just might start leaving your lights on throughout the day just because you have the illusion of free power for the burning. David Owen is a writer for The New Yorker and author of The Conundrum. He believes that innovation and energy-efficient technology have increased energy use rather than reduced it. He argues that efficiency can't solve all our energy woes. And David, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, a lot of people will be discouraged by what you're saying. What can you say to cheer them up, David?
Well, it's energy is wonderful. We've made our lives, you know, extraordinary. We live the way nobody's lived in history. The fallacy is in thinking that by getting better at using energy, in effect making it cheaper for ourselves, mm-hmm. we cause total global energy consumption to fall. I can make my life better by using more efficient devices. But mm-hmm. If you look at the history of energy consumption, our success at turning efficiency gains into overall consumption reductions is problematic, to say the least. In fact, you see the trends all go the other way. The more efficient we've gotten at using energy, the more of it we've used, the better we get at doing things, the more things we do.
So that obviously begs the question, what the heck do you do about something like that then?
Well, we know how to make energy consumption go down. We just don't like it. But when you make energy more expensive, people use less of it.
That's the key.
What you're doing is you're sort of creating artificial scarcity by making it more expensive. When we simply make our machines more efficient, what we're doing is artificially making it cheaper. Yeah. In 2008 – something happened that not even the most optimistic environmentalists or climatologists had expected, which was that energy consumption and carbon output worldwide went down and by a significant amount. But it wasn't that the world had suddenly acquired a green consciousness. It was that oil had gotten extremely expensive and the global economy had imploded. Nobody would ever advocate destroying the world economy in order to improve our performance in a number of environmental areas. But from an environmental point of view, there are things to be said for recessions.
Yeah.
The trick is how you accomplish the same result without the misery that economic decline causes.
So when President Obama sort of sits back, David, and says, hey, we're raising our fuel efficiency standards by a significant percentage in the next, 12, 13 years, you sit back and think, what?
Well, it'll make my life better. It won't solve the larger problem. It won't solve the global energy or carbon problem because as we make driving cheaper for ourselves, we do more of it. And even if I can't do more of it myself, even if I already drive as much as I possibly can, the impact spreads across the global economy.
Because other people do it even if you're not.
Other people do it. People in parts of the world that don't drive now. You look at China driving is growing so fast that they had to put a limit on the number of driver's licenses and car registrations that they issue. They can't build roads fast enough to accommodate those cars.
Yeah.
That problem, we don't make that problem better by pushing down the cost of driving. We push it the other way. Someone asked me what a green car would actually look like, and I said, well, you know, it would get about 5 miles to the gallon. It wouldn't have an air conditioner or a heater. You'd have a top speed of maybe 25 miles an hour. You know, you could get your kid to the hospital, but you would not commute 100 miles to work. You would not live south of 250th Street and go to work downtown.
And you're saying these trends are clear, that Prius owners, for example, folks who pride themselves on maybe doing something good for the planet, the studies show that, in fact, those folks end up driving more in the long run.
Well, once again, you can't really see this if you look at the individual – just solely at individuals or at single end uses.
Right.
What you have to look at is global energy consumption
okay.
and see what the effects are over time. And most of the studies that are done by people who are efficiency advocates, you'll look at, as I make my light bulbs more efficient, what happens – to the energy I use as I turn on my lights. And it goes down. I mean, I can – if I change my desk lamp to a compact fluorescent, my desk lamp will use less. But what you have to do is pull back and look at the whole – the global economy or the history of the human race. You know, every energy-consuming device that I own right now is vastly more efficient than any energy-consuming device that I had when I was a kid.
And yet?
And yet my energy consumption has gone up. The world's energy consumption has gone up. We want to make the world better by making our own lives better. But it's seldom as easy as that. Mm-hmm. Another example is air travel. A couple of years ago, I traveled to Australia to give a talk on climate change at a state-sponsored conference there. And if you want to see a really big carbon footprint, just look at the sort of book tour itinerary, the frequent flyer mile balance of almost anybody who goes around talking about the environment. But the my share of the jet fuel that we burned on that trip to Australia was equal to the total amount of energy consumed in a year, you know, for all purposes by the average human being. It's huge. And yet when we talk today about, oh, should I take a vacation in Australia? It's not the cost of the ticket usually that makes us hesitate. It's the thought of, oh, just do I really want to spend all that time, you know, sitting in a seat watching movies?
Yeah.
Our jets are 70% more efficient than the jets of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that hasn't made our consumption of jet fuel go down or on an individual basis or on a global basis. As we've made it easier and cheaper, we've done more of it. And you'll hear people now say, you know, oh, God, I hate to fly now. The planes are always full. The airport's
terrible. Saying that.
Yeah, yes. We were just saying it to each other. But that's a very green it's a very green thing. You know, the more you pack them in, the more unpleasant you make travel, the less likely we are to do it. And that's a good thing environmentally, but it's not something that we're all clamoring for.
So basically you're saying that we're sort of tinkering around the edges when it comes to our Priuses and our compact fluorescent bulbs, that we're well-intentioned, maybe that's worth something, but the bottom line is energy consumption is going up around this planet, not going down, and we still face some very, very serious decisions that in the end will affect all of our lifestyles in significant ways.
Yes, that's very true. You know, you look at global population is supposed to rise by about a third between now and the middle of the century. But global energy consumption is forecast to more than double over that same period.
Wow.
And most of that increase will be in fossil fuels. We just can't generate energy from solar panels on a scale that meets even the increase in human energy use.
Yeah.
So I think the way people who worry about the environment usually pose the question is to say, do we have the will to make a sufficient investment in wind and solar and other non-carbon energy sources? The real question is, do we have the will globally to leave some very large fraction of the world's remaining supply of fossil fuels in the ground, unburned forever?
Because
it's a different question. It's because the carbon content of the atmosphere is cumulative. You know, as you burn a little bit more, it goes up, and it takes a very long time for any sort of natural process to bring that down. So basically, every little bit you add adds to the total. The difficulty is that every little saving we make on the other end is not cumulative.
Oh, I see.
I save a little energy.
Sure.
I unplug my phone. I haven't brought down global energy consumption by that amount because I've saved myself some money, which I'm going to spend in some other way, which will also entail the consumption of energy.
Hmm. And at some point, you can't put any more up there, I gather, or we get to a point where we're in serious trouble.
Right. And where that point is you know, you could say we're in serious trouble now in terms of being able to turn it around. It's a big ship to try to move. And it's hard to see. The difficulty is that the problem is the contributions to the problem are individual. But doing something about it on a significant scale requires something global, everybody together. And we don't know how to do that.
Our guest today is David Owen. He's author of the book, The Conundrum. He's from Kansas City. In fact, he'll be speaking this evening at 7 at the UMKC Student Union. That event is free. Just swing on by to see David tonight at 7 o'clock. If you want to join our conversation as we talk about energy consumption and what this planet really needs to do to get it down, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up to date at kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Rick from Overland Park. Rick, you're on the program. Good morning.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the conversation today. Very, very interesting to me. The point that I want to make is that we have to wag the dog as a people with the debates that just took place. There was no mention of climate change. Nobody asked the question. The candidates didn't deal with the question that I think a lot of us citizens are aware that with 7 billion people, we change the chemistry of the world. So I appreciate what the guest is saying, and I know that he agrees with me. His point is true. I have a Prius, and I knew that it wasn't going to solve the problem, but it was a vote to industry that there's money to be made because people care. So if we can just invent storage for these solar panels on our roof of our houses, it's really going to change, the paradigm of the whole need to use the free clean energy of the sun. So does my point make sense?
Yeah, sure. I think that the storage issue you talk about is critical, and the cost issue of solar panels. What we really need is to make solar panels work is to push down our energy consumption to a level that probably most people who put solar panels on their roofs are not interested in trying to achieve. It's hard. There's a reason why the world chose fossil fuels as their energy source. They're extremely compact. In terms of energy storage, they work way better than any battery we have by orders of magnitude. You can put oil in the ground for 100 million years and it not only doesn't lose its ability to hold energy, it actually increases.
Hmm.
It's very compact. You can move it around. You can run a vehicle with it. The batteries are much harder. I was talking to a physicist at MIT who said, we chose 100 years ago, we chose fuels rather than batteries, and there's a reason that we did that.
Two things. One, the negawatt, right? That concept of using less is very important. And we need a vision. We need leaders to give us visions, to not get discouraged in the message that you give today, that, we all need to work toward, the bigger picture of using clean and not screwing up the chemistry of the world.
True. The negawatt is an idea of Amory Lovins, who's an energy efficiency enthusiast, and the idea is that that each one of us wastes an extraordinary amount of energy, and that we could live very comfortably on simply on the energy that we waste today. The difficulty with negawatts is that as you create them, you don't take your savings and put them on a compost heap. You tend to put them in something. You invest them in something else, inevitably, an energy-consuming activity. And if you look back through our history, that we've been getting more efficient since the time of the Industrial Revolution, but we used that efficiency to leverage our consumption. If you look at cars today, if you look solely at the miles per gallon, you're not really looking at the environmental challenge of cars. The environmental challenge of cars is that I can walk out of this building, I can get into my car, I can drive from here to probably not to the either side of the continent, maybe to the tip of South America. I'll never need to service the car other than to refuel it. I can feed myself without leaving my car. My children could watch movies in the back seat. I can control the climate. It's more comfortable than any room in my house. It's better furnished. it is we've made it so efficient in that sense. We've made driving so efficient that we're delighted to do it. You know, there's been studies of commuting, and it's interesting that the ideal commute in this study, in the mind of the workers who were polled, it wasn't zero. People enjoy being in their cars. Mm-hmm. You know, they like, it's like a little time to decompress on the in the morning. You get away from your family and your kids. You listen to NPR. You listen to a book on tape. You have this perfect climate control. And the same thing coming home. You decompress. And as we've made our cars more pleasant places to be and more useful, more efficient, more productive, we've been willing to live farther away from home. Mm. If we were still driving Model Ts, nobody would commute 50 miles to work. You couldn't do it. You certainly couldn't do it in the winter.
Rick, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
You know, I'm just wondering, I think Rick might have mentioned, we just went through this presidential campaign and hardly a word about global warming, that issue at all. In fact, some folks were surprised when President Obama mentioned global warming when he was in Chicago and about ready to return to Washington in the wake of his victory. What do you make of that, that after all of this, after the big storm on the East Coast, after other indications and the hot summer that things aren't quite right, that we just aren't willing to embrace the whole challenge of it to any significant extent?
No, it's true. And I think it's because it would be political suicide for anyone really to advocate the steps that it would take. And that's not a fault of politicians, which is the way we tend to think of it. It's because the people who would be throwing them out of office would be us.
That's right.
But I think that there is a sort of a change afoot. And these things tend to take place slowly. You had Mayor Bloomberg in New York actually mentioning climate change when he endorsed a presidential candidate.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty unusual. Although he's in the last of his three terms, so he didn't have anything at risk. But I think that it's too bad that that issue has become as ideological as it has, because there's nothing ideological about changing global circumstances.
And it didn't used to be that way, right?
No, it didn't. And you know, you could think of circumstances in which the conservative position would be that we need to be addressing this, or that the evangelical position would be we must be doing something to protect God's earth. It doesn't necessarily seem to me inevitable that the division even exists. But I think if it can be stripped of some of the emotion, we'd be much better at addressing it. The difficulty is, if you imagine if there were suddenly scientists discovered a meteor or an asteroid that was heading toward Earth, was going to pass in 40 years, was going to pass close enough to Earth to cause significant calamity on
right.
Earth. You could imagine, all the countries of the world, scientists from all over, we were, laying down our weapons
and
addressing
together.
This problem. We'd figure it out. We launch a rocket with H-bombs on it or something and address it. The difficulty with climate change is it's bigger, more complicated. The threat is much harder to quantify. The solutions are – we don't know what the solutions are, even as we talk about them. And the solutions are hard. There are people – if you look at one of the most successful ways to generate non-carbon power in the world is hydropower, hydroelectricity dams, very low carbon consequences to generating electricity with dams, and yet you have environmentalists on both sides of that issue. Well, there are people who are advocates of generating electricity with water power. At the same time, there's a very strong body of green-thinking people whose goal is to take down existing dams, to free rivers that we currently dam in order to generate power. So, and all the issues are like that. There are people who are essentially on the same side of the overall issue who take opposing positions on the specifics, and that makes it very difficult.
And so what would it take, do you think, David, to help us turn the corner and sort of get some attention paid to global warming on a significant scale?
I'm not sure.
I'm not either. I, I,
the,
keep...
uh,
Hurricane Sandy's apparently not having a lot of impact. And
I always wish that I had an easy answer, and there isn't. And I think it's also a year ago. I live in Connecticut. A year ago, we had a 2-foot snowfall on Halloween, and everybody, power was out for a week in my little town, and everybody was focused on this. This time, the storm missed us, and it was very hard, sitting in a house where the power is on, to even think about the people who are in places where it's off. So I think it's an unusual kind of crisis in that it is slow and long term and cumulative, and there are these intermittent crises, but they don't happen everywhere.
Yeah.
They aren't always in our mind. They go away and we go back to the way things were. It's hard to stay focused on a problem that you really, think this is something that we need to focus on for the rest of the existence of the human race, not just something that we need to do this year.
Yeah. Again, we're visiting with David Owen. He's the author of The Conundrum. He speaks tonight at 7 at the UMKC Student Union. You can just drop by to see him and hear him. We have an email here from Kelly from Lenexa. She's commenting on what you said earlier about the whole idea of increasing energy costs as a way to reduce consumption. But she says if that's done globally, this would put a damper on emerging economies. On the other hand, raising efficiency standards for vehicles, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning equipment, appliances, and other equipment drives innovation and pushes manufacturers to design more efficient equipment. We need a sensible combination of both of these measures. I'm a mechanical engineer in the building design and energy field, she says.
Yeah, she's exactly right about the vast majority of people in the world who should be using more energy. You could transform the lives of hundreds of millions of people simply by finding some way to provide to them, no more energy than I forgot to turn off in my bedroom when I came over here.
Mm-hmm.
100 watts a day would change the lives of hundreds of millions of people in the world. One difficulty with the thinking of efficiency gains as a solution is that it's first the problem that I mentioned earlier, which is the historical difficulty, the historical impossibility of turning those efficiency gains into actual reductions in total consumption.
Mm.
The other is that those efficiency gains don't stay put. We make our air conditioners more efficient. That doesn't cause total energy to go down because we use more air conditioning, and as we use it more, we make it cheaper, and it spreads into parts of the global income ladder where it didn't exist before.
In what sense?
One of the largest consumers of air conditioning right now is China, where actual purchase of air conditioners is subsidized by the government. A majority even of air conditioner units in the world are manufactured in China. India is one of the hugest, largest growing markets for air conditioning. And one thing that happens with air conditioning is that once you have, say, an air-conditioned office, your unair-conditioned house begins to seem intolerable to
mm-hmm.
you. I was in
mm-hmm.
Las Vegas
That's a good point.
A couple of years ago, and somebody described automobiles to me as devices for transporting air conditioning between buildings. When I was born in 1955. At that point, there was less than 20% of American households had air conditioning of any kind, even a room air conditioner. Now, that percentage has flipped. Nowadays, more than 85% of American households have air conditioning, and most of it is central.
Mm-hmm.
We now use more energy air conditioning spaces in the United States than we used for all purposes in 1955 when I was born. So you can say my air conditioner is 50% more efficient than the one I had 10 years ago. But that hasn't caused air conditioning related energy consumption to fall. In fact, it's had this opposite effect. We make it cheaper. We make it more appealing. And as we use more of it, we lose the ability to live without it.
So what does the government say to you? Because the government seems so focused on, increasing energy efficiency standards up and down the product lines. What do they say to you when you make these arguments? Because in a sense, you're saying that what they're doing is worthless.
I think that pursuing efficiency is the only strategy that, for example, the Department of Energy can follow. And I talked to Stephen Chu, the Secretary of Energy, about this, and he said he had just held a conference where or been part of a conference where it was countries from all over the world. Nobody was against energy efficiency. Everybody is for it. It's something we can all support. And I think that alone should make one a little bit suspicious, because you think about how divisive energy and climate issues are. To say that our solution is not controversial suggests that maybe it isn't really addressing the things that we're in disagreement about. And I think it's also difficult, too. Stephen Chu is the Secretary of Energy of the United States. He's not the Secretary of Energy of the world. And so the problem, our problem as American consumers, we want to get our economy back going again. We want to make our lives as wonderful, continue to increase the wonderfulness of our lives.
Yeah.
It's a different issue from the global one, which is it does seem intractable for the very reason the caller said. How do you price energy in a way that makes it more expensive for the people who use the most of it, that would be us, without pricing it out of the reach of the people who don't use any of it right now,
yeah,
and whose lives would be, you know, who should be using more fossil fuels?
That's David Owen. He's the author of The Conundrum. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our good conversation here. We'll talk a little more about recycling, an activity that so many of us partake in, and exactly sort of the pros and cons of that when it comes to reducing energy consumption on this planet. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed our visit with our political pundits yesterday, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, our DVD gurus return with a review of the latest James Bond film, Skyfall, and their favorite Bond villains from the last 50 years. This hour, we're visiting with David Owen. He's a writer for The New Yorker and author of The Conundrum. He's talking about the whole notion that innovation and energy efficient technology has increased energy use rather than reduced it. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. What about the whole notion, David, of recycling? And so many folks are so diligent about putting stuff out every week. You know, we do. And yet those big trucks drive through the neighborhood, burning up all kinds of energy to pick up the recycling and then deliver it. And then what the energy that gets consumed and having to transform those raw products back into something else that's useful. What's your take on it all? Are we wasting our time or not?
I think we often are. The challenge with it is how good it makes you feel in a way. And I'm always extra proud of the bigger the pile that I leave.
Somehow you're doing something good.
The better I feel about it.
Yeah.
Even though you think about, I was in Beijing 6 or 7 years ago, and saw in this sort of ancient alley neighborhoods people setting out things to recycle. It was a pile. You could cover the pile with your hand. The garbage, too. It wasn't that they were being bad about recycling. They were consuming much less. There was less waste because the level of consumption was low. Nobody listening to this radio broadcast would like to live in a single room in a 1,500-year-old alley with a public bathroom down the hall.
Yeah.
But down the alley. But I think there are lots of ways in which we use problematic measures, mainly to make ourselves feel better about continuing to consume. I was on vacation a few years ago with a group of people, and the in the community where we were, newspaper recycling had ended. We're no longer picking up recycling, and people felt couldn't put a newspaper in the trash. It just felt sinful.
Right.
And yet to pick up that newspaper.
It should be sinful, by the way. Yeah.
To pick up that newspaper. That's right. Yeah. We love it. I'm not saying anything bad about newspapers because we love the Kansas City Star. But to pick up that newspaper, somebody had driven 5 miles down and 5 miles back in a car alone to buy it. And that wasn't problematic. Maybe he'd driven in a more efficient vehicle. That didn't feel like an environmental problem. What felt like an environmental problem was taking this newsprint, which is probably pretty close to the total end of its useful cycle anyway, that has to be hugely processed to remove the ink from it. That was what made them feel bad. So I think it can kind of distort the way we view the real scale of our difficulties.
Well, so what's your bottom line on it? Is it useful then to continue this practice, which has sort of swept the country, or do we need to rethink it somehow?
I think there are lots of different ways to rethink it, and I'm not an expert on it. But there are many of the things that we use that are not in any sense recyclable because we, it's very easy to recycle an aluminum can because it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
There, you think of all the electronic stuff
that
we have. The phone that I just got to replace my perfectly functioning phone that I had no reason to get.
You too, eh?
Yeah. And so is the answer that we get better at recycling that first phone, which I no longer use, that I put it in the little envelope and send it back? Or is it that we try to think about this whole idea that these super extraordinary pieces of electronics that make us so happy for about 5 minutes and then we basically throw them away?
Yeah.
Haven't always been that way about our gadgets. You think of the telephones when I was growing up, from the Bell system, the Bell telephone in your house.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't own it. There was one in the house.
That's right.
You rented it from the phone company.
That's right.
Because the phone company owned it, it lasted forever. You could throw it around and not break it, that incredibly heavy black Bakelite telephone.
Yeah.
That was a green device because there was nothing in it that would stop working. We just lost interest in it. And now I have a – if I'd kept every phone I've thrown away in my life, I could fill a box with them.
We have a good email here from Teresa, who writes us this at UpToDate@KCUR.org. I drive a hybrid, and the efficiency feedback that I receive from the car's computer definitively leads me to less gas use by improving the way I drive. I also do not drive a single extra mile because of the fact that I drive a hybrid. I hate driving and traffic congestion. Nothing on this earth would make me want to drive more.
Right.
So there.
Now, once again, this is to say, it's not, you can't see it if you look at individuals. If you look at individual behavior, I expect as I buy a more fuel efficient car for my personal gasoline consumption to go down. But the car is sort of the fulcrum of our consumption. The car makes possible, the environmental issue isn't the car in your driveway, it's the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
Kansas City is a good example.
What do you mean by that? Yeah,
it's everything that the car makes both possible and necessary. You look at Kansas City. When I was a kid here in the late 60s and early 70s, the places we used to go, you'd drive out into the country to get in to do bad things and get into trouble, are now so far in town. They're practically downtown. There are people who live on the south side of Kansas City who've never even seen downtown,
mm-hmm.
Except maybe whizzing past it on their way to the airport because it's so far away from that kind of inefficient, energy-hungry, environmentally devastating development, it's good for the local economy, but it comes at an extraordinary environmental cost. All the duplicated infrastructure, all those the miles of highway,
mm-hmm.
all the repeated shopping malls, all the redundant hospitals, all the power lines that have to go out to those far-flung suburbs.
Yeah.
Those are all made possible by the car. So as you maintain the viability of driving as an activity, you're also supporting all these others. It's very difficult. And so in a way, I'm one of the few, I may be the leading, if not the only, advocate of the environmental value of traffic congestion. Traffic congestion has environmental value because it makes people less willing to drive, less interested in driving. Most of what pass for environmental measures related to cars are really aimed at making driving more pleasant.
Hmm.
How do we get rid of congestion? Congestion isn't an environmental problem. It's a driving problem. And as you solve the driving problem, you make the environmental problem worse.
Hmm. Again, our guest, David Owen, author of the book, The Conundrum. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. We're talking about energy efficiency this morning. Let's go to Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How you doing, Dave?
Thanks for holding on, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah, I got a question for you, and this has to do with energy consumption. Why is it that when the price of gasoline goes up, the energy companies, the oil companies, they always say that it's because of supply and demand, but they never seem to run out of the supply enough to where they can't get it to every pump in the United States to charge people $4 and $5 a gallon for it. So, you know, it's all about greed to me, and that's the bottom line. And another question I want to ask you is exactly. I mean, you probably don't know the answer, but does it cost a lot of money to produce energy? Does it cost a lot of money to produce electricity? If we don't have any idea what it costs to actually produce electricity, but we know that these electric companies are making millions and billions of dollars every year.
Well, it does cost. It costs a lot, and I don't know. I couldn't exactly break it down, but it costs more and more. We've gotten one interesting thing about global supplies of fossil fuels is that we keep outpacing what people even a very few years ago thought were the Earth's total reserves. We now actually have greater reserves globally than people thought we did. Not many years ago, of oil. And the reason is that we've gotten much better at extracting oil from places where not very long ago we didn't even know it existed. Invariably, that requires extraordinarily sophisticated, expensive in every sense techniques, some of which are expensive in the sense of the environmental damage they do, all of which are expensive in terms of just the sheer cost of, for example, drilling miles deep in the ocean. As for the cost of fuel, you know, oil is a. I think that oil is misrepresented in many political discussions. I think we tend to have the idea that if we were just more aggressive about drilling for oil in our own country, we would push down the price of gasoline in the United States. The oil market is a global market. Oil goes into what's basically one big barrel and comes out of one big barrel. The price we pay, the price that a oil producer pays, if somebody strikes oil in Texas, they're not going to start selling it to Texans for selling gasoline to Texans for $1.50 because they can sell it for more. They can sell. There's a global market for oil. It goes into the global market, it's fungible. There's a global price. It's hard to believe sometimes, and it was hard for me to believe when I paid – in August of 2008, I paid $4.86, I think, a gallon for home heating oil, which right. People in Kansas City don't even know about. People in Europe right now pay more than twice what we do for a gallon of gasoline. Mm-hmm. Canada does supply – Canada is a net exporter. Of fossil fuels. It is energy independent. The Canadians pay the same price for gasoline that we do.
And they consume – I mentioned the Europeans are consuming less as a result.
They consume less as a result. The other reason they consume less is that Europe is sort of – is more densely populated. The destinations are shorter. People often say, well, Europeans take trains and that's why their carbon footprint is smaller than ours. The real reason is that the distances they travel just aren't as long, although they're coming around to a kind of an American-style infatuation with the car. I think that the key about efficiency is that if you pursue efficiency as the policy, you're constantly making energy cheaper to yourself. You're constantly eliminating the pressure to do something about energy consumption. If, on the other hand, you tackle it from the other side, from the supply side, from making energy less available, then if you cap consumption, if you make it more expensive, if you do things that push down artificially the supply of energy, then efficiency gains that we make enable us to live the way we used to, but at lower levels of consumption. If we approach it the other way, the target is always it's always receding. It's always getting farther away.
In fact, you say, speaking of efficiency, that dense, efficient, intelligently organized cities are the future of the human race.
They definitely are. When my wife and I got married 35 years ago and we lived for 7 years in a utopian environmentalist community in New York State, we didn't have a car. We did our shopping on foot. When we traveled, we almost always took public transportation. We didn't have a clothes dryer. Our electric bills worked out to about $1 a day. That utopian community was New York City. It was Manhattan. Our apartment was 69th Street and 2nd Avenue.
Some folks out here are thinking you've got a strange view of a utopia right now.
Yeah. Well, if you look at how you prosperous affluent populations with low energy and carbon footprints, if you look around the world, it's dense cities. It's Hong Kong is probably the global leader. Now, this isn't necessarily – I'm not saying that this is that's an appealing idea. My wife and I moved away from New York City as quickly as we could, and we now live about as inefficiently as possible. But the you double the price of oil and you feel it less in a dense city. The only places in this country where public transportation really work, for example, are dense cities.
Yeah,
New York City has half of all the subway stops in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Almost a third of the public transit passenger miles traveled in the United States are in the metropolitan New York area. It doesn't work without density.
So, David, leave us with some hope here today. what should people be thinking about? What should they be telling their elected officials about? Where's the bottom line here that we should be thinking as you leave here today?
I think there's no easy answer to any of these things. The only people I know who environmentalists who are super optimistic and think there's an easy answer are the ones who believe in nuclear power. And it may be. Mm-hmm. But I think that we need to look coldly at our consumption and think about it realistically rather than with the sort of magical thinking that we tend to do. That just by, we're always willing to buy something to solve a problem, or we're willing to make sacrifices that aren't really sacrifices. I'll raise my own chickens. I'll eat better tasting eggs.
Right.
This is what I will do for the earth. I think the real solutions is often the case of complex problems are they're tougher and they're the kind of problems that you don't know the answer to, that a journalist isn't going to have the answer to. But I don't think we get closer to a solution by engaging in policies that simply over the long term make them worse.
Hmm. David Owen's been our guest. Again, he's a writer for The New Yorker, and he is author of The Conundrum. He speaks at 7 tonight at the UMKC Student Union. And David, thanks so much for your time. Enjoyed having you
today. Oh, Steve, thank you.